KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
SeattleSymphony.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Calls to boycott Russian vodka and the 2014 Russian Winter Olympics are intensifying in the wake of a new Russian law that bans distribution of so-called homosexual propaganda to minors. We're going to hear more about Russian attitudes towards homosexuality later this hour. Also, the role of faith when we're confronted by death. The three interfaith amigos discuss religion and mortality. As you just heard, yesterday's metro shooting has bus riders and drivers wondering again about the safety of the transit system. And as you also heard in the afternoon news conference yesterday, King County Executive Dow Constantine called the shooting an isolated incident. Data seem to back that up. Since 2006, reported assaults on Metro drivers have been on the decline. County Executive Constantine joins me now from Metro's Ryerson base in Soto. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Marcy.
First of all, what do you know about the condition of the Metro bus driver who was shot?
Well, I haven't spoken with him or his wife this morning, but when I spoke with his wife last night, he had family with him. He was in spirits and doing okay. I know he's going to have quite a long time for recovery, but the fact is that I think we were, considering the circumstances, very lucky yesterday that the situation didn't turn out worse than it did.
So he is expected to make a recovery.
He is, and you know, one of the interesting things was when I visited him in the hospital yesterday morning, and there were two things he said. One, he wanted me to let people know that he was going to be okay. And two, he immediately asked after the condition of his passengers. Was everybody on the bus okay? Which is pretty remarkable for a guy who's been shot several times.
Well, let's talk about the passengers a second. According to eyewitness accounts, it was, as you might expect, pretty much pandemonium with passengers scrambling to get off the buses. Is there some sort of protocol in a situation like this for passengers?
Well, I'm not an expert on that, but I know that our drivers got the rear doors open so that passengers could get off the bus that was on 2nd Avenue where the perpetrator was ultimately shot. The driver got the back door open, and people were making their way, admittedly in a somewhat haphazard fashion, towards the back of the bus and out the back door. So I really appreciate the actions of these drivers in trying to protect their passengers. And I have to say that, you know, the extensive training that our drivers receive in keeping themselves, their buses, and their passengers safe pays off in a situation like this.
What kind of training do they receive?
Well, since 2006, of course, the assault numbers have been going down. Assaults include a whole range of actions from you know, fisticuffs to spitting, for mm-hmm. example. So just to give you an idea. But we engage the drivers in cooperation with the union in training to de-escalate situations. As I said yesterday, we want them to be peacekeepers, not enforcers. We don't want to set up the expectation that they are cops, which they are not. And by constantly reinforcing the idea of de-escalating tense situations, we've been able to reduce by quite a bit violent incidents on the bus.
I know that in the wake of violence that happened in the bus tunnel or the downtown transit tunnel, there was a beef up of security and some armed forces. What kind of security patrols at this point are on buses that are just going about their regular routes?
Well, we have currently 64 full-time Metro or police officers, and then there's another, I think, 36 dedicated to Sound Transit. And those are all King County deputies, but they are you know, paid for by the different transit agencies and assigned to security on those agencies' routes. And we work in very close concert with the Seattle Police Department on the downtown Seattle routes, and you saw the Seattle Police respond immediately and perform magnificently yesterday the minute trouble arose. So I have to say that you know, yesterday, considering a very bad circumstance, the systems that we put in place worked well.
And just a last question has to do with the downtown ride-free zone. From what I've read about the particular shooter's personal life. He was very troubled. He had a history with drugs. But do you have any sense that, that getting rid of the downtown ride-free zone might have exacerbated the situation?
No, quite the opposite. In fact, I'm here at the Ryerson base today talking with drivers, and they say that since the ride-free zone went away, and we're moving toward eventually a low-fare pass that covers the entire county, but since the ride-free zone went away, they've had less problems with concentrations of people on the bus who are causing trouble. And what we want to see is, if I might broaden this, a society where we can get a hold of someone like this guy and get them into the appropriate mental health and substance addiction treatment and be able to keep them in mental health treatment. And that didn't happen. And the fact is, the federal and state cuts to mental health programs, which King County has worked to backfill, have really impacted our ability to intervene with people who are a danger to themselves and others.
Dow Constantine, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
Dow Constantine is King County Executive. This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman.
It's 9:13, KUOW 94.9, News and Information. Today in the noon hour, Washington State Insurance Commissioner Mike Kreidler answers your questions about Obamacare. Get your question in early by calling 206-221-3663. That's 206-221-3663.
OW comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
65 degrees in Seattle. Today's projected high in the upper 70s with mostly sunny skies this afternoon. Tonight expect a low in the upper 50s, partly cloudy, and on Wednesday a high again in the upper 70s, close to 80, with mostly cloudy skies on Wednesday.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. In June, the Russian government passed a law that prohibits distribution of so-called homosexual propaganda to minors. That ignited international fury, prompting calls to boycott everything from Russian vodka to the 2014 Winter Olympic Games in Sochi, Russia. Recent polls show only 16% of Russian citizens say homosexuality is socially acceptable. Given the increasing acceptance in other countries, why are Russians overwhelmingly anti-gay? Elizabeth Wood joins us now. She's a professor of history at Massachusetts Institute for Technology. Professor Wood, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Can you explain first what the recent Russian law against distribution of homosexual propaganda is intended to do?
Well, it's actually not a law that names homosexuality per se. It names non-traditional forms of sexual relations, and it claims that it is addressed to minors, that it's a law to protect children. And it's part of a larger pattern of extremely conservative laws, all of which are framed in this protection language as if the Russian people need a strong state to protect them.
Well, in reading coverage of this, when Russian officials were confronted with criticism from outside the country, they said that discrimination against gay men and lesbians in Russia is illegal. Is that true?
Well, technically. The problem is, technically this law is only on the propaganda of homosexuality or non-traditional sexual relations. The problem is, of course, that as soon as they put in this kind of law, it can be used by any thugs, any hooligans to go after gays and lesbians. So it's a classic case of picking the marginal group, stigmatizing them, and then it's open field, open fire by conservatives, some of whom are egged on by authorities and or the authorities simply fail to step in any way. The police stand by when demonstrators are pelted with eggs or beaten or severely beaten up.
And that was very recent. There was a large protest in Moscow, as I understand, and the police did watch that happen.
Exactly. And then they arrested the gay demonstrators, even though the ones perpetrating the violence were the anti-gay violence. And what we know, I don't know as much about that particular incident, but we know from many, many other cases that often the people who are opposing a measure are bussed in to take that kind of violent action. So it's not just, it can be actually perpetrated by various forces in society.
As I understand it, and I haven't been there, but I'm sure you have, in Russia's large cities, there are pretty active and fairly large gay communities. Is that a relatively recent development, or have urban centers always been havens for gay culture in Russia?
It's quite, I would say it's a fairly recent phenomenon, and it's still quite hidden. You know, gay bars will be behind a wall where there's no sign outside that that's what it is. Patrons can be harassed very easily. The thing about this kind of attack on marginals is it's not actually, the danger is not so much the legal authorities as the people who say, well, I'm going to beat you up if you don't give me a bribe. And that Lori Essig recently had a piece in the Washington Post, and she described exactly that happening in the late 1980s, and it's still happening today. That people who are, because there's so much stigma attached to it, people in the gay community are very frightened that someone will blackmail them at their place of work, blackmail them at the university, blackmail them somewhere else.
It sounds very pre-Stonewall United States, in other words, mid-20th century. Has this been the attitude towards homosexuality in Russia for most of the 20th century as well, or is this a point that it has evolved to?
Well, it's a strange thing. On the one hand, in the period before 1917, sodomy was absolutely illegal. The church went after it vigorously. There were also secular laws against it. Lesbianism was not criminalized. And then in the early Soviet period, homosexuality was legalized, along with a number of other things like abortion and prostitution, on the theory that criminalizing these things created all kinds of social dangers. It was better to legalize and, you know, try to help the individual. But it wasn't entirely benign, but it was on the whole legal. And what's happened in the post 1993 period is that it's been recriminalized, and it was re-legalized in 1993, but then in this 2012-2013 season, we're starting to see the recriminalization. And it's not, as I say, it's not exactly criminalization. It's against discussion. The word in propaganda in Russia can mean any kind of discussion. So there's a group of young people from the Netherlands who were in Murmansk meeting at a human rights camp, and they tried to show a film about homosexuality. Bingo, they were kicked out of the country and they can't come back for 3 years. So it's the tightening has been happening even before the new law passed in the Duma. There have been groups that were fined under the law. LGBT groups have been attacked as non-governmental agencies and told that they had to register as foreign agents, and if they didn't, they were going to be fined. There was an earlier anti-gay bill right in the city of St. Petersburg. So the conservative move is ratcheting up.
We're talking with Elizabeth Wood, professor of history at MIT, about attitudes in Russia towards gay men and lesbians. And you mentioned that lesbians weren't considered in early law. Are they singled out at this point, or are they just ignored because they're women?
Again, it just says the new law just says non-traditional sexual behavior. As far as I know, it doesn't differentiate between men and women. But there have been moments, times, there have been lesbians who've been, in the Soviet era, put under psychiatric care, thrown in the gulag, and so on. So it was quite a flourishing lesbian and gay subculture within the prisons. They were sex segregated.
When you talk about this recent sort of hardening of attitudes, does that derive from Vladimir Putin? Is it a personal thing, or is there something else going on in the country itself?
I think it's a combination of things. On Putin's side, I think it's very, and his handlers, I think we have to always think of Putin as kind of a collective phenomenon because much of what he does is I think, planned, and some of it what he does is not. I think it's a reaction to the protests of last year, and so a concerted decision to change his image from the macho image of the bare-chested, virile man to the protector, the patriarch, the father of the nation. But it's not just him. It's also the Duma, the Russian parliament, which is acting like lapdogs in this. And the threat, the sword of Damocles over their heads, this is a bit complicated, is that they can lose their position in the Duma, and this has started happening this exact same time period. And once they lose their position in the Duma, they can be charged with corruption and financial misdeeds. Which means they are inclined to go, oh, yes, 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 we will pass all the most conservative legislation imaginable.
What role, you mentioned the church in the early 20th century played a role in this. What role does it play at this point in time?
Well, the church is more and more coming out in favor of piety, in favor of submission. They specifically spoke out against the protests against Putin last year, saying that pious Russian people should listen to the church and listen to the elders. So the church is playing more and more of a moral role, and I've argued in my work that the Soviet state also tried to play that kind of moral instructive role. So it makes sense that as the Putin administration and the church work more and more closely together, they're taking this anti-Western, anti-modern kind of stance.
So there's all this sort of convergence of factors, it sounds like, as you explain it, Professor Wood. How do the increased international calls to boycott vodka or to boycott the Olympic Games, how do they impact Russian attitudes either on the official level or on the level of the citizens?
Well, the Olympics are a wonderful, wonderful paradox for the Russians. On the one hand, Putin especially, personally, has gone out of his way to make this the great shining moment for Russia. The Olympics will prove that Russia is a great power and it has great visibility, great modern stance. But, of course, that's an international competition. So they're going to have to bring in the athletes, and many of the gay athletes have said, look, we may not go. And organizations are saying we may boycott because of the gay issues. So trying to be international while trying to close the gates of Russia, as it were, and keep out those foreign ideas, those are direct contradiction with each other. And I think for people who want to support the gay community in Russia, it's a great moment to put pressure on the Russians. They desperately want those Olympics to happen, and they want every single nation to appear and participate. And so they've been going back and forth. Some officials say, oh, no, we won't prosecute anybody. Any gay athletes who come will be fine. And other officials have said, yes, but the minute they open their mouths, we will prosecute them on using Russian laws. So it's not clear what's going to happen on that front.
And it doesn't even seem that there is unanimity among gay athletes about it, because athletes themselves train for 4 years to have the chance to shine in this moment. So I'm sure they don't all want a boycott.
Yes, and the Olympics are a symbol of peace, a symbol of cooperation. So there's, you know, many very legitimate sentiment that they should go forward, that boycotting them in 1980 over the Afghan war was a mistake. So there's definitely two sides or more of that issue. You're absolutely right.
Elizabeth Wood, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us today.
My pleasure.
Elizabeth Wood is a professor of history at Massachusetts Institute for Technology. This is KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman.
KUOW 94.9, a weekend weather forecast and a hike to match that forecast. That's this morning at 9:53.
On the next Fresh Air, Jenji Kohan, the creator of the new Netflix series Orange is the New Black. It's based on the memoir of the same name by Piper Kerman, who was sent to prison for having carried drug money. The series tells the stories of the diverse women in the prison. Kohan also created the Showtime series Weeds. Join us.
You can hear that tonight on our second program service, KUOW 2.
I'm Steve Scherer. Starting September 3rd, you'll hear Ross Reynolds, Marcy Silman, and me on the record. We're tracking local, national, and international news and culture every weekday from noon to 2. Join us.
Find out more about the record at our website, kuow.org. 66 degrees in Seattle. Today's projected high in the upper 70s, mostly sunny. Tonight, a low temperature in the upper 50s, partly cloudy skies.
From KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Death is something that we all have to grapple with at some time. Many of us take comfort from and refuge in our spiritual beliefs as we try to come to grips with an impending loss. The three interfaith amigos join us with a look at what religion has to say about mortality and the afterlife. They are Imam Jamal Rahman, co-founder and Muslim Sufi minister at Interfaith Community Sanctuary and adjunct faculty at Seattle University. Rabbi Ted Falcon is a teacher of Jewish meditation and spirituality. He's also the founder of Makom Or Shalom, a synagogue in Los Angeles, and Beit Aleph Meditative Synagogue in Seattle. And last but not least, Pastor Dom McKenzie, a former minister and head of staff at University Congregational United Church of Christ in Seattle. And Katie Sewell is with me now.
Yeah, I talked to the Interfaith Amigos about this topic and also asked them to respond to the common accusation that God is just a story to make people feel better about life and death. I started the conversation asking them a really personal question. I asked them, where are you on your own spiritual journey when you consider your own death? Imam Jamal Rahman answered first.
So, you know, it's a truism that death happens because of birth, and the fact that we are reluctant to look at death because we are scared of living fully. Mm-hmm. For me, when I think of death, I think of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, as a model. And he mentioned two things which really splash in my heart. One insight he had is that it is better to blush in this world than in the next world. And that really resonates. That really makes me realize, am I making my life meaningful? I'm thinking of this Bengali poet, Tagore, who said, you know, you spend your days and nights stringing and unstringing your instruments, but the song you came here to sing remains unsung. So at this stage of my life, I think of those things, that things that are meaningful. The second thing Prophet Muhammad said is that, you know, what really matters in a person's life is doing righteous deeds. Those two words appear again and again and again in the Quran. Righteous deeds. Will you be mindful of doing righteous deeds? You know, you can have wealth and money, but you leave them in the palace. You can have beautiful family and friends. They'll go as far as the grave, but beyond that, it is righteous deeds. So those two things keep me alive in my time of my life journey.
What do righteous deeds qualify as?
I think of Prophet Muhammad who said, do good things according to your capacity. God never tires of giving rewards unless you tire of doing good things. And the righteous deeds most loved by God are the ones that are done regularly, no matter how small they are. That is a constant reminder to me. Can you do it regularly, Jamal, no matter how small they are?
Do you have a personal example?
Well, for example, you know, I remember a good friend who used to always give money to homeless people. But we never questioned, you know, will they spend it on wine or on drugs? You do it for the sake of God. Any amount of money I have, which I feel I can spare, because the Quran says, give freely of what you love, you know, it needs to have some substance. So I'm willing to give it without questioning. That's a small act, for example. Or a good smile. Or as always remember, but Prophet Muhammad said, you know, the greatest thing you can do is just gladden the heart of another human being, if you can.
Don, what would you say? Where are you on your personal journey when you consider dying?
I have found that as some friends are becoming sick and dying, and as I, you know, lose parents, for example, I find that the way I look forward is different from the way it used to be. I don't know if I'm more or less invested in looking forward than others, but I think when I was younger, I looked forward to something hopeful. Who knows what? I'm not sure I could have said specifics. But I find that as I grow older, the whole way I look forward is changing from something involving doings and havings to something more spiritual. I've been sick a couple times and almost died once, and I'm not sure if I've really come to terms with that. Death is that great mystery that if I think about it in terms of our traditions, at least at an intellectual level, doesn't seem so scary. But when you get down to it, there's such a big mystery there that it requires some intentional spiritual practices and so forth. And we do live in a culture that really does its best to deny the reality, of death.
Well, when you say you're looking forward and it's becoming more spiritual, what does that mean?
Well, the road ahead is shorter than it used to be, you know. And I give thanks for people who have been examples for me who have died. I call them the lights on the road ahead. So instead of thinking about the future in terms of what I'm going to do, where I'm going to be, what I'm going to have, and so forth, I begin to think about it in terms of, or just wonder about it, in terms of, you know, that great question that we rarely ask, at least not out loud, what does happen when we die? What does happen? Of course, I don't know what happens. You know, we have only the wisdom of our traditions that suggest the fact that life does not end with death. What that means, we don't know. I mean, it's been talked about in very literal terms. It's been talked about in very abstract terms. But there is something that existed before I was born and something that will exist after I die. I don't know what that is.
Ted? Rabbi Ted, what do you think? What would you say?
I don't want to talk about it.
Too bad, pal.
You know, it is interesting to me, as I listen to Pastor Don and talking about the shift, you know, as the road ahead is smaller than the road behind, I'm aware that there's a part of me, the ego part, the separate self, that gets afraid. And that's the part that doesn't want to talk about it. That's the part that doesn't want to look at it. That's the part that just doesn't want to think about my friends dying or the people who are close to me. Doesn't want to realize that my closest relationships, you know, one of us is going to leave first. And that's the way it is, which on an ego level, we have two ways of dealing with it. One is a relatively unhealthy way of denial, pretending it's not happening. And the other way, which is more healthy, is really striving to honor the moment, you know, so that the connections, that which is shared, becomes even more precious and even more special. And, you know, to have that sense of it's just wonderful. And there is a self bigger than the ego. And that self sees birth and death in a larger context. You know, my tradition teaches that we are vehicles for a soul which is bigger than our separate self. The soul is on a larger journey. And to the extent to which we have, the word I often use is informed our soul, connected to our soul level, is I think the connection to which there is less of a fear of that passage and more of a sense of curiosity and a sense of wanting to take the very best of myself, to leave, you know, to celebrate life and to witness. My favorite story, which I inevitably tell at memorial services, and I'll do it a little more quickly, is about the rabbi who, before teaching, his students went into his office, closed the door, and some moments later reappeared and somehow had a greater sense of confidence. When he grew older, he stopped closing the door quite so tightly, and the students would peek in to see what he was doing. And he was sitting at his desk and reaching into the lower left-hand drawer and taking out a black book. And he would open it, and he would study. And at a certain point, he would nod his head, close the book, put it back in the drawer, and get up. You know, the students would run back to their seats. Came time for that rabbi teacher to make his transition, to leave his body. And after the funeral, students from various years rushed back to the classroom because they knew what they wanted to see. What was it that he was looking at, studying every day before class? And the bravest among them rushed, came in and actually sat down in his chair, reached into that lower left-hand drawer, pulled out the book, opened it up. Every page in that book was blank except one page. And on that page, there was one sentence. And the sentence said, "Remember the difference between the container and that which it contains." Mm. Remember the difference between the container and that which it contains. And when I look at death, that's how I look. The container, each of us is an absolutely unique container that only comes once.
You know, Brother Ted, Katie, can I pick up on one point Brother Ted mentioned?
Yes.
It's critical to point out. You know, if we believe that we are nothing more than our personality,
right,
which is nothing more than a bundle of conditioned reactions to life circumstances, if we believe we're only our personality and we don't have a higher self, Christ nature, Elohim nature, Allah nature, Buddha nature, if we believe it's only personality, then all we want in life is to just run after scraps of pleasure, accumulate more things, and live lives of quiet desperation. And this is what all the great sages in Islamic spirituality say, that the greatest sadness a person has upon death, who believes that, is that this person says, "My goodness, I have not tasted the water of my own essence. I never connected with who I really am. And for that reason, I was always involved in trivialities, dramas, melodramas, never quite got into what the great sages say, being in the center of the wheel. The wheel goes up, the wheel goes down, that's life. But I have that feeling of that abiding equanimity, that joy, because I'm in the center of the wheel. I get to know who I really am."
There was a book by a columnist in Los Angeles when I lived in Los Angeles. And the book came from a letter that he had received, and it said, "Spend all your kisses, Mr. Smith." And I have that sense of, you know, have I hugged enough?
Yes.
Have I loved enough? Have I shared enough?
Yes.
You know, and the ultimate answer is going to be no. You know, because in that way there's never enough. And the answer is also yes.
I'm speaking with the three interfaith amigos. That was Rabbi Ted Felk, and you also heard Imam Jamal Rahman and Pastor Don McKenzie's here. Did you want to add anything to the train that they were just on? Or
No, I depend on my colleagues for wisdom. I think that was terrific, yeah.
See, that shows he's beyond his personality. He has the divine quality of modesty and humility flows through him.
Well, there are so many questions I want to ask. But I did want to touch on that one of the main criticisms that you hear about religious faiths are that it's a made-up story that's meant to make people feel better about themselves and their own mortality. And I was hoping to get your response to that.
I think the first thing that comes to me when I hear you say that is that a lot of the stories of that religion sells appears to me to make us feel less good about ourselves.
You mean like heaven and hell?
You know, rather than making us feel better about ourselves. Make us feel more judged, more concerned about our natural urges, our natural loves, you know, more self-conscious. as if there's some kind of authority out there who's watching us all the time. So I hear what you're saying, but I'm not sure it functions quite that way.
I totally agree. You know, for example, the Day of Judgment. The Islamic teachers who are steeped in spirituality say, you know, this is so incongruous of an all-loving, merciful God asking us what did we do when he knows even before we acted. That's why Sufis say, you know, on the Day of Judgment, we shall say, oh God, plead and advocate on my behalf with yourself. Do what is worthy of you, not what is worthy of me. Then the question of heaven, you know, sensual, luxuriant gardens. But there's a verse in the Quran that says, really, even beyond these gardens of everlasting bliss is the presence of God. There's something more that we yearn for. Hell, you know, the scorching fire, boiling water. But there's a verse that says, hell is your mother, meaning it's like the womb of your mother. It's not a place of punishment. It's a place of purification. Those who haven't done the work have a second chance in purifying themselves and being delivered anew. So I see more joy, more hope in those metaphorical descriptions than in the literal descriptions.
Judaism has less of a focus on the afterlife than either of either Islam or Christianity. It's not that there's a belief that there's nothing afterwards. It's just that that's not the focus.
Right.
The focus is clearly on ethical, righteous, loving, compassionate acts in this world, and that's difficult enough.
Right.
There's not the sense of heaven and hell spelled out with as much fervor and as much enjoyment or lack of enjoyment, you know, as there is in other traditions. And that's an interesting thing. There's more of a, you know, like if you want to get to heaven, Christianity and Islam, you know, provide greater avenues. If you want to focus almost on life is now.
But just even in Islamic spirituality, for example, there is this very beautiful, beloved female saint named Rabia, 9th century. She was often seen running through the streets of Basra in Iraq with a pail of water in one hand and a torch of fire in the other. What are you doing? She said, you know, I'm really going to quench the fires of hell and set fire to heaven. Because if we perform our acts in this world because of fear or a desire for rewards, we're not living, really.
Right.
That's why she has this wonderful verse. She says, oh God, if I worship you for fear of hell, burn me in hell. If I worship you for love of heaven, deny me the gates of heaven. But if I worship you for you yourself, please, I beg you, begrudge me not your everlasting beauty.
I think this exists in all of our traditions.
Yes.
You know, you mentioned, you used the phrase, are these stories made up? I think that was it.
Well, yeah, the criticism is that people think that people like religion because it makes them feel better. These are stories that make you feel better.
Right, and of course, that is part of the function of religion, is to be reassuring. How it becomes reassuring is another question. But in some ways, I think it has to do with how we make sense of our lives, of life in general, and how we connect to that very important concept that my colleagues have talked about, the greater self. Some people never do. Some people might hope it's out there, but never manage to make the connection, sometimes partly because of what I would think of as a misunderstanding of some of these stories. Because religion has been used to manipulate people. There's just no question about it, at small levels and huge imperial levels. But I think that people are often, they don't feel competent or confident enough to say, how does this story connect with the way I make sense of my life? What gives me a sense of meaning and purpose in my life? How does that? Because there is something essentially legitimate about how people do that, assuming that, you know, there's nothing violent or hurtful about it. Sometimes we make sense of our lives in ways that actually do hurt us. Sometimes we don't realize at the time. But I think heaven and hell, It's a fascinating, potentially very manipulative concept, either one. And we also experience heaven and hell in between birth and death. There's just no question about it. How else would we know what it's about? So I'm leery of those concepts, and I'm much more Jewish, I think. I'd like to be away from those kinds of things.
Really briefly to end, what should the reality of mortality, the reality of the fact that we're all going to die, what impact should knowing that have on our lives?
You know, I love that wonderful verse by Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, which my brothers have heard many, many times. They know it by heart also. Prophet Muhammad said, Jamal, when you arrived here on earth, everybody was laughing and smiling, but you were crying and crying and crying. Live such a life that when you depart for the other world, everybody around you is crying and weeping, but you are laughing and smiling. I'd like to live such a life. I'd like to think that the knowledge of death is going to motivate me to live like that.
And I think it should be seen as an invitation to live as fully as possible in the best possible way, not like somebody else, you know. And let's get out from under all the shoulds that are, you know, the product of parent-child relationships, but as adults. We should see religion and spirituality and the reality of death in a context that says there are terrific opportunities, and you, whoever you are, have some way to live into those things.
Hmm. Ted, final word?
Most of the time we ask, is there life after death? I think the more crucial question is there life after birth? And how do we feed and support, nurture and nourish the fullness of the life that we are living, you know, so that we are in the moment and that we are able to open to and express greater compassion and greater love and bring healing and ask the question, how can I make things better here? Not accumulate more for myself and not make things give me more power or more fame or whatever it is, but how can we legitimately make it better for each other? And I think that focus takes care of the issue of heaven and hell. Because if we're living in heaven now, we don't have to worry.
Rabbi Ted Falcon is a teacher of Jewish meditation and spirituality. He's also the founder of Makom Or Shalom, a synagogue in Los Angeles, and Beit Aleph Meditative Synagogue in Seattle. With him is Imam Jamal Rahman, co-founder, Muslim Sufi minister at the Interfaith Community Sanctuary and adjunct faculty at Seattle University. And Pastor Don McKenzie is the former minister and head of staff at University Congregational United Church of Christ in Seattle. Together, they're the three interfaith amigos. Thanks, all three of you, for coming in.
Thank you so much, Katie.
This is Weekday.
Ten minutes till 10 o'clock. Hike in the weather coming up in just a few minutes, but Katie Sewell's with me. And yesterday, Katie, we made our big announcement of big news at KUOW that this is the last live week of Weekday for the week of the 19th and the week of the 26th. We're going to delve back into the archives and look at 20 great years of Weekday.
Yeah, Weekday is celebrating its 20-year anniversary this month, and so we're going all the way back through the 20 years to resurrect some of those long forgotten but really great interviews.
There have been a lot of them over the years. And then the other part of the news was that on September 3rd, Weekday and the forces of the conversation are melding minds. And we're going to bring you a new and different kind of show called The Record that's going to run from noon to 2 every day. It's going to be a mix of local news and culture, a little bit of politics, a little bit of international news. And Steve Scher, Ross Reynolds, and I will co-host that show. You will be listening from afar because you're going to Italy.
Yes, I will be on the other side of the world. My husband accepted a fellowship to study over in Rome for the academic year, and I have decided to go with him.
I think that's very wifely of you.
Yes, and do some radio experimentation, some writing, things like that. Who knows? Find myself? I don't know. Not that I've lost myself, but I'll be listening, and I am very excited to find out what the record's going to sound like and how the three of you hosts are going to work together. I think it's going to be pretty exciting.
We're looking forward to it. But one of the questions that a lot of you listeners had yesterday was, well, what happens at 9 o'clock?
Right.
we don't just pull the plug, though. Actually be...
Dead air for 3 hours.
No. Many of you have been enjoying John Hockenberry at 1 o'clock in a show called The Takeaway. And John is a longtime public radio guy born in Oregon and just has... He's an excellent, excellent host. And so The Takeaway moves till 9 o'clock. And then... From 10 to noon, it's a show that neither of us has heard.
Yeah, brand new.
Here and Now, it's called.
Here and Now, brought to you by National Public Radio. I think it's going to be similar in format to Morning Edition, but of course, we haven't heard it yet. So we're all looking forward to that, too.
Yeah, it's NPR has and all public radio folks have been looking for a good way to bring you the up-to-date news of the day, and to also give you a little bit of context, the depth that you've come to expect from public radio. And on the record, we hope, and literally on the record, here, you hold me to this, that's what we hope to do with our new show, and we hope that you enjoy the changes, and you know, it's good. September, it's a good time to turn the corner and start something new.
Yeah, the fall.
The fall. So that's what's ahead for us at this moment. What is ahead is Michael Fagan and a little quick check on the weather and then a couple of hike suggestions as we move into the dog days of summer. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Marcy.
So it's not quite yet the dog days of summer. Summer's still here, right?
That's in force, especially today and tomorrow. Highs both days in Seattle close to 80. We start to see some changes late Wednesday, more likely Thursday and Friday. We have a weak weather system that tries to push in. For Seattle, mainly see cooler temperatures, highs in the upper 60s, slight chance of a drizzle, slight chance of some mountain showers Thursday and Friday, and then sun returns on Sunday. So for the hikes, we're going to keep everyone busy as summer starts to wind down. Our first one is at Mount Rainier National Park. Sunrise entrance is the Sourdough Ridge, Frozen Lake, Shadow Lake Loop. The flowers are still out, which is great. This offers great views of Mount Rainier, and again, the best day for views will be today and Wednesday, and then sun comes back and forth again on Sunday. There's two lakes to visit, as I mentioned, Frozen Lake and Shadow Lake. The numbers on the hike are not too bad. 3 miles round trip, 500-foot gain. If you want more, there's Burroughs Mountain and Fremont Lookout. And this is also passes a walk-in campground for the beginning campers. Shadow Lake has some campgrounds there, so
nice.
That's one thing to think about. You'll need your National Park Pass and Green Trails Map 269S. Now, the next hike, we're going to keep it close in. There's a lake-to-lake hike in Bellevue. Has easy access, obviously, which is great. And, you know, with school just around the corner for the stay-at-home parent, that gives you a quick release of some of your energy. That's easy to get to, and you can also go to Mercer Slough Blueberry Farm and pick some blueberries.
So lake to lake, what lake to what lake?
Oh, yeah, I should state what I thought. When you go to the trailhead, it's obvious. You can start at Lake Washington, and it's 10 miles to Lake Sammamish.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, real nice. It's a boardwalk. It just has a lot of variety. You could even go to the Bellevue Botanical Garden. So you can go as short or as long as you want. Like I said, it's 10 miles total. Third hike is another close-in hike, Coal Creek Falls. This trail is in Bellevue. It's part of the Cougar Mountain Regional Park System. This is a short hike, 2.5 miles round trip, 300-foot gain. And if that's not enough, there's 36 miles of trails in the entire system, so you can pick it. Last but not least, and this is really one of the favorites of many, right near Snoqualmie Pass, Kendall Catwalk. You'll get a good workout on this. There's no doubt about it. That's 11 miles round trip, 2,700-foot gain. You get fabulous views from the top of the ridge. If you want to go a little further, another mile further, you see two lakes. And this part of the Pacific Crest Trails.
Oh.
Some folks do this, take off the entire summer and start in Mexico early in the summer and end up in Canada at the end of summer. So, Marcy, it's...
Yes, I'm all set.
Well,
I'm ready to go, Michael.
It might be too late for that one. And that's, you'll need your Forest Pass and Screen Trails Map 207S. So there you have it. We have four great hikes to keep you busy over the next couple weeks.
So two are a little more adventurous, and two are close in. So,
right, and the even the one at Rainier is pretty. It's obviously a drive to Mount Rainier, but it's a shorter hike there. But the Kendall Catwalk is certainly the ambitious one, that's for sure.
So, Michael, as we head into the Labor Day weekend, you head out into the mountains as well?
That's right. I like to wait towards the end of August when the bugs hopefully are on vacation. And so I'll be doing a couple backpack trips over the next couple weeks. I'll go out for several days, come back, get refreshed, reload up on food, clean the laundry, and go back out again. So I'm looking forward to couple nice weeks, and the weather effect's going to hold up.
Well, I hope you're right about that one. You can, and I'm sure you'll be posting pictures from these at hikewashington.net.
That's correct. We'll be keeping everyone appraised.
Well, Michael, thanks for joining us, and happy hiking.
Thank you.
Michael Fagans with West Coast Weather LLC. His blog, Fagans Weather World, gives us some good hikes to match the weekend weather forecast. And just a summary, there's a ridge of high pressure that's going to bring warm and mostly sunny conditions today and tomorrow. Then a weak trough of low pressure moves inland on Thursday and Friday, and that could bring us some clouds and cooler conditions over the Thursday-Friday period. There is a chance of drizzle in the city and a few mountain showers. So best chance of views right now are to head out today or tomorrow. And we've got four hikes to pick from: Mount Rainier, Sourdough Ridge, Frozen Lake, Shadow Lake Loop, the Bellevue Lake to Lake hike, very easy, 10 miles altogether, Bellevue, Issaquah, the Coal Creek Falls at Cougar Mountain Regional Park, and for the classical hikers among us, Kendall Catwalk at Snoqualmie Pass. And as you heard Michael mention, that is part of the Pacific Crest Trail, but just a portion of that. So have fun out there in the woods. Coming up in the next hour of the program, we're going to talk to Jerry Kornfield from the Everett Herald about the Senate Majority Coalition and their transportation package. Also going to talk with a man who has collected more than 90,000 wartime letters. Andrew Carroll has compiled them into various volumes, and now he has transformed these letters into a one-act play that is having a reading in Seattle tonight and Bellingham tomorrow. We're going to talk about that. And our Green Days gardeners, the original Troika, Willie Galloway, Marty Wingett, and Greg Rayburn join us for a last long call-in as Weekday continues its last live week here on KUOW Seattle. I'm Marcy Silman.
W949 News and Information. Greg Louganis won gold medals in diving at the Olympics in the 1980s. As a gay athlete, he shares his thoughts on Russia's new anti-gay law and how it might affect the upcoming Winter Olympics. That's today at 1:40.
10 years ago, a large swath of the U.S. and Canada plunged into darkness. North America's largest blackout was traced to...
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.